Tonight I will be reading A Country Christmas by Louisa May Alcott. Dear Emily, I have a brilliant idea and at once hasten to share it with you. 3 weeks ago I came up here to the wilds of Vermont to visit my old aunt, also to get a little quiet and distance, in which to survey certain new prospects which have opened before me, and to decide whether I will marry a millionaire and become a queen of society, or remain the charming Miss Vaughan and wait till the conquering hero comes. Aunt Plummy begs me to stay over Christmas, and I have consented, as I always dread the formal dinner with which my guardian celebrates the day. My brilliant idea is this. I'm going to make it a real old-fashioned frolic, and won't you come and help me? You'll enjoy it immensely, I'm sure, for Aunt is a character, Cousin Saul worth seeing, and Ruth a far prettier girl than any of those city rosebuds coming out this season. Bring Leonard Randall along with you to take notes for his new books. Then it will be fresher and truer than the last, clever as it was. The air is delicious up here, society amusing, this old farmhouse full of treasures, and your bosom friend pining to embrace you. Just telegraph yes or no, and we will expect you on Tuesday. Ever yours, Sophie Vaughan. They will both come, for they're as tired of city life and as fond of change as I am, said the writer of the above, as she folded her letter and went to get it posted without delay. Aunt Plummy was in the great kitchen making pies, a jolly old soul, with a face as ruddy as a winter apple, a cheery voice, and the kindest heart that ever beat under a gingham gown. Pretty Ruth was chopping the mince, and singing so gaily as she worked that the 4-and-20 immortal blackbirds could not have put more music into a pie than she did. Saul was piling wood into the big oven, and Sophie paused a moment on the threshold to look at him, for she always enjoyed the sight of his stalwart cousin, whom she likened to a Norse Viking, with his fair hair and beard, keen blue eyes, and 6 feet of manly height, with shoulders that looked broad and strong enough to bear any burden. His back was toward her, but he saw her first, and turned his flushed face to meet her, with the sudden lighting up it always showed when she approached. "I've done it, Aunt, and now I want Saul to post the letter so he can get a speedy answer." "Just as soon as I can hitch up, cousin," said Saul, and he pitched his last log, looking ready to put a girdle round the earth in less than 40 minutes. "Well, dear, I ain't the least mite of objection, as long as it pleases you. I guess we can stand it if your city folks can. I presume to say things that will look kind of singular to 'em, but I suppose that's what they come for. Idle folks do dreadful queer things to amuse 'em." And Aunt Plummy leaned on the rolling pin to smile and nod, with a shrewd twinkle of her eye, as if she enjoyed the prospect as much as Sophie did. "I shall be afraid of 'em, but I'll try not to make you ashamed of me," said Ruth, who loved her charming cousin even more than she admired her. "No fear of that, dear. They will be the awkward ones, and you must set them at ease by just being your simple selves and treating them as if they were everyday people. Nell is very nice and jolly when she drops her city ways, as she must here. She will enter into the spirit of the fun at once, and I know you'll all like her. Mr. Randall is rather the worse for too much praise and petting, as successful people are apt to be, so a little plain talk and rough work will do him good. He is a true gentleman, in spite of his airs and elegance, and he will take it all in good part if you treat him like a man and not a lion." "I'll see to him," said Saul, who had listened with great interest to the latter part of Sophie's speech, evidently suspecting a lover, and enjoying the idea of supplying him with a liberal amount of plain talk and rough work. "I'll keep him busy if that's what they need, for there'll be a sight to do, and we can't get help easy up here. Our darters don't hire out much, work to home till they marry, and don't go gadding round getting their heads full of foolish notions and forgetting all the useful things their mothers taught 'em." Aunt Plummy glanced at Ruth as she spoke, and a sudden color in the girl's cheeks proved that the words hit certain ambitious fancies of this pretty daughter of the House of Bassett. "They shall do their parts and not be a trouble. I'll see to that, for you certainly are the dearest aunt in the world to let me take possession of you and yours in this way," cried Sophie, embracing the old lady with warmth. Saul wished the embrace could be returned by proxy, as his mother's hands were too floury to do more than hover affectionately round the delicate face that looked so fresh and young beside her wrinkled one. As it could not be done, he fled temptation and hitched up without delay. The three women laid their heads together in his absence, and Sophie's plan grew apace, for Ruth longed to see a real novelist and a fine lady, and Aunt Plummy, having plans of her own to further, said, "Yes, dear," to every suggestion. Great was the arranging and adorning that went on that day in the old farmhouse. for Sophie wanted her friends to enjoy this taste of country pleasures, and knew just what additions would be indispensable to their comfort, what simple ornaments would be in keeping with the rustic stage on which she meant to play the part of prima donna. Next day, a telegram arrived accepting the invitation for both the lady and the lion. They would arrive that afternoon, as little preparation was needed for this impromptu journey, the novelty of which was its chief charm to this blasé people. Saul wanted to get out of the double sleigh and span, for he prided himself on his horses, and a fall of snow came most opportunely to beautify the landscape and add a new pleasure to Christmas festivities. But Sophie declared that the old yellow sleigh, with Punch the farm horse, must be used, as she wished everything to be in keeping, and Saul obeyed, thinking he had never seen anything prettier than his cousin when she appeared in his mother's old-fashioned camlet coat and blue silk pumpkin hood. He looked remarkably well himself in his fur coat, with hair and beard brushed till they shone like spun gold, a fresh color in his cheek, and the sparkle of amusement in his eyes, while excitement gave his usually grave face the animation it needed to be handsome. Away they jogged in the creaking old sleigh, leaving Ruth to make herself pretty with a fluttering heart, and Aunt Plummy to dish up a late dinner fit to tempt the most fastidious appetite. "She has not come for us. There's not even a stage to take us up. There must be some mistake," said Emily Herrick, as she looked about the shabby little station where they were set down. "That is the never-to-be-forgotten face of our fair friend, but the bonnet of her grandmother, if my eyes do not deceive me," answered Randall, turning to survey the couple approaching in the rear. "Sophie Vaughan, what do you mean by making such a guy of yourself?" exclaimed Emily, as she kissed the smiling face in the hood and stared at the quaint cloak. "I'm dressed for my part, and I intend to keep it up. This is our host, my cousin Saul Bassett. Come to the sleigh at once, he'll see to your luggage," said Sophie, painfully conscious of the antiquity of her array as her eyes rested on Emily's pretty hat and mantle and the masculine elegance of Randall's wraps. They were hardly tucked in when Saul appeared with a valise in one hand and a large trunk on his shoulder, swinging both onto a wood sled that stood nearby as easily as if they had been handbags. "That is your hero, is it? Well, he looks it, calm and comely, taciturn and tall," said Emily in a tone of approbation. "He should have been named Samson or Goliath, though I believe it was the small man who slung things about and turned out the hero in the end," added Randall, surveying the performance with interest and a touch of envy, for much pen work had made his own hands as delicate as a woman's. "Saul doesn't live in a glass house, so stones won't hurt him. Remember, sarcasm is forbidden and sincerity the order of the day. You are country folks now, and it will do you good to try their simple, honest ways for a few days." Sophie had no time to say more, for Saul came up and drove off with the brief remark that the baggage would be along right away. Being hungry, cold, and tired, the guests were rather silent during the short drive, but Aunt Plummy's hospitable welcome and the savory fumes of the dinner awaiting them thawed the ice and won their hearts at once. "Isn't it nice? Aren't you glad you came?" asked Sophie, as she led her friends into the parlor, which she had redeemed from its primness by putting bright chintz curtains to the windows, hemlock boughs over the old portraits, a china bowl of flowers on the table, and a splendid fire on the wide hearth. "It's perfectly jolly, and this is the way I begin to enjoy myself," answered Emily, sitting down upon the homemade rug, whose red flannel roses bloomed in a blue list basket. "If I may add a little smoke to your glorious fire, it will be quite perfect. Won't Samson join me?" asked Randall, waiting for permission, cigar case in hand. "He has no small vices, but you may indulge yours," answered Sophie, from the depth of a grandmotherly chair. Emily glanced up at her friend as if she caught a new tone in her voice, then turned to the fire again with a wise little nod, as if confiding some secret to the reflection of herself in the bright glass andiron. "His Delilah does not take this form. I wait with interest to discover if he has one. What a daisy the sister is! Does she ever speak?" asked Randall, trying to lounge on the haircloth sofa, where he was slipping uncomfortably about. "Oh, yes, and sings like a bird. You shall hear her when she gets over her shyness. But no trifling, mind you, for it is a jealously guarded daisy and not to be picked by any idle hand," said Sophie warningly, as she recalled Ruth's blushes and Randall's compliments at dinner. "I should expect to be annihilated by the big brother if I attempted any but the sincerest admiration and respect. Have no fears on that score. But tell us, what is to follow this superb dinner? An Appleby?" spinning match, husking party, or primitive pastime of some sort, I have no doubt. As you are new to our ways, I'm going to let you rest this evening. We'll sit about the fire and tell stories. Aunt is a master hand at that, and Saul has reminiscences of the war that are well worth hearing if we can only get him to tell them. Ah, he was there, was he? Yes, all through it, and is Major Bassett, though he likes his plain name best. He fought splendidly, and had several wounds, though only a mere boy when he earned his scars and bars. I'm very proud of him for that. And Sophie looked so as she glanced at the photograph of a stripling in uniform set in the place of honor on the high mantelpiece. We must stir him up and hear these martial memories. I want some new incidents, and shall book all I can get, if I may. Here Randall was interrupted by Saul himself, who came in with an armful of wood for the fire. Anything more I can do for you, cousin? He asked, surveying the scene with a rather wistful look. Only come and sit with us, and talk over war times with Mr. Randall. When I've foddered the cattle and done my chores, I'd be pleased to. What regiment were you in? Asked Saul, looking down from his lofty height upon the slender gentleman, who answered briefly, In none. I was abroad at the time. Sick? No. Busy with a novel. Took 4 years to write it? I was obliged to travel and study before I could finish it. These things take more time to work up than outsiders would believe. Seems to me our war was a finer story than any you could find in Europe, and the best way to study it would be to fight it out. If you want heroes and heroines, you'd have found plenty of them there. I have no doubt of it, and shall be glad to atone for my seeming neglect of them by hearing about your own exploits, Major. Randall hoped to turn the conversation gracefully, but Saul was not to be caught, and left the room, saying with a gleam of fun in his eye, I can't stop now. Heroes can wait. Pigs can't. The girls laughed at this sudden descent from the sublime to the ridiculous, and Randall joined them, feeling his condescension had not been unobserved. As if drawn by the merry sound, Aunt Plummy appeared, and being established in the rocking chair, fell to talking as easily as if she had known her guests for years. Laugh away, young folks, that's better for digestion than any of these messes people use. Are you troubled with dyspepsia, dear? You didn't seem to take your victuals very hearty, so I mistrusted you as delicate, she said, looking at Emily, whose pale cheeks and weary eyes told the story of late hours and a gay life. I haven't eaten so much for years, I assure you, Mrs. Bassett, but it was impossible to taste all your good things. I'm not dyspeptic, thank you, but a little seedy and tired, for I've been working rather hard lately. Be you a teacher? Or have you a profession, as they call a trade nowadays? Asked the old lady, in a tone of kindly interest, which prevented a laugh at the idea of Emily's being anything but a beauty and a belle. The others kept their countenances with difficulty, and she answered demurely, I have no trade as yet, but I dare say I should be happier if I had. Not a doubt on it, my dear. What would you recommend, ma'am? I should say dressmaking was rather in your line, ain't it? Your clothes is dreadful tasty, and do you credit if you made 'em yourself, said Aunt Plummy, surveying with feminine interest the simple elegance of the travelling dress, which was the masterpiece of a French modiste. No, ma'am, I don't make my own things. I'm too lazy. It takes so much time and trouble to select them that I have only strength left to wear them. Housekeeping used to be the favorite profession in my day. It ain't fashionable now, but it needs a sight of training to be perfect in all that's required, and I have an idea it would be a sight healthier and usefuler than the painting and music and fancy work young women do nowadays. But everyone wants some beauty in their lives, and each one has a different sphere to fill, if one can only find it. Appears to me there's no call for such much art when nature's full of beauty for them that can see and love it. As for spears and so on, I have a notion if each of us did up our own little chores smart and thorough, we needn't go wandering around to set the world to rights. That's the Lord's job, and I presume to say he can do it without any advice of ourn. Something in the homely but true words seemed to rebuke the three listeners for wasted lives, and for a moment there was no sound but the crackle of the fire, the brisk click of the old lady's knitting needles, and Ruth's voice singing overhead as she made ready to join the party below. To judge by that sweet sound, you have done one of your chores very beautifully, Mrs. Bassett, and in spite of the follies of our day, succeeded in keeping one girl healthy, happy, and unspoiled, said Emily, looking up into the peaceful old face with her own lovely one full of respect and envy. I do hope so, for she's my ewe lamb, the last of four dear little girls. All the rest are in the burying ground, side of father. I don't expect to keep her long, and don't ought to regret when I lose her, for Saul is the best of sons. But daughters is more to mothers somehow, and I always yearn over girls that is left without a brooding wind to keep 'em safe and warm in this world of tribulation. Aunt Plummy laid her hand on Sophie's head as she spoke, with such a motherly look that both girls drew nearer, and Randall resolved to put her in a book without delay. Presently Saul returned with little Ruth hanging on his arm and shyly nestling near him as he took the three-cornered leather chair in the chimney nook, while she sat on a stool close by. "Now the circle is complete and the picture perfect. Don't light the lamps yet, please, but talk away and let me make a mental study of you. I seldom find so charming a scene to paint," said Randall, beginning to enjoy himself immensely, with a true artist's taste for novelty and effect. "Tell us about your book, for we have been reading it as it comes out in the magazine, and are much exercised about how it's going to end," began Saul, gallantly throwing himself into the breach, for a momentary embarrassment fell upon the women at the idea of sitting for their portraits before they were ready. "Do you really read my poor serial up here and do me the honor to like it?" asked the novelist, both flattered and amused, for his work was of the aesthetic sort, microscopic studies of character, and careful pictures of modern life. "Sakes alive, why shouldn't we?" cried Aunt Plummy. "We have some education, though we ain't very genteel. We got a town library, kept up by the women mostly, with fairs and tea parties and so on. We have all the magazines regular, and Saul reads out the pieces while Ruth sews and I knit, my eyes being poor. Our winter's long, and evenings would be kinder lonesome if we didn't have novels and newspapers to cheer 'em up. I am very glad I can help to beguile them for you. Now, tell me what you honestly think of my work. Criticism is always valuable, and I should really like yours, Mrs. Bassett," said Randall, wondering what the good woman would make of the delicate analysis and worldly wisdom on which he prided himself. Short work, as Aunt Plummy soon showed him, for she rather enjoyed freeing her mind at all times, and decidedly resented the insinuation that country folk could not appreciate light literature as well as city people. "I ain't no great a judge about anything but naturalness of books, and it really does seem as if some of your men and women was dreadful uncomfortable creatures. 'Pears to me it ain't wise to always be picking ourselves to pieces and prying into things that ought to come gradual by way of experience and the visitations of Providence. Flowers won't blow worth a cent of if you pull 'em open. Better wait and see what they can do alone. I do relish the smart sands, the odd ways of foreign parts, and the sarcastic slaps at folks' weak spots. But Massey knows we can't live on spice cake and Charlotte Russe, and I do feel as if books was more sustainin' if they was full of everyday people and things, like good bread and butter. Them that goes to the heart and ain't soon forgotten is the kind I hanker for. Miss Terry's books now, and Miss Stowe's, and Dickinson's Christmas pieces. Them's real sweet and cheerin' to my mind." As the blunt old lady paused, it was evident she had produced a sensation, for Small smiled at the fire. Ruth looked dismayed at this assault upon one of her idols, and the young ladies were both astonished and amused at the keenness of the new critic who dared express what they had often felt. Randall, however, was quite composed and laughed good-heartedly, though secretly feeling as if a pail of cold water had been poured over him. "Many thanks, madam. You have discovered my weak point with surprising accuracy. But you see, I cannot help but picking pokes to pieces, as you've expressed it. That's my gift, and it has its attractions, as the sale of my books will testify. People like the spice bread, and as that is the only sort my oven will bake, I must keep on in order to make my living. So rumsellers say, but it ain't a good trade to foller, and I'd chop wood for I'd earn my livin' harmin' my feller man. 'Pears to me I'd let my oven cool a spell, and hunt up some homely, happy folk to write about. Folk that don't borrow trouble and go looking for holes in their neighbors' coats, but take their lives brave and cheerful, and remembering we're all human, have pity on the weak, and try to be as full of mercy, patience, and love and kindness as Him who made us. That sort of a book would do a heap of good. Be real warmin' and strengthening, and make them that read it love the man that wrote it, and remember him when he was dead and gone. I wish I could." And Randall meant what he said, for he was as tired of his own style as a watchmaker might be of the magnifying glass through which he strains his eyes all day. He knew that the heart was left out of his work, and that both mind and soul were growing morbid with dwelling on the faulty, absurd, and metaphysical phases of life and character. He often threw down his pen and vowed he would write no more. But he loved ease, and the books brought money readily. He was accustomed to the stimulant of praise, and missed it as the toper masses his wine, so that which had been once a pleasure to himself and others was fast becoming a burden and a disappointment. The brief pause which followed his involuntary betrayal of discontent was broken by Ruth, who exclaimed, with a girlish enthusiasm that overpowered girlish bashfulness, "I think all the novels are splendid. I hope you'll write hundreds more, and I shall live to read 'em." "Bravo, my gentle champion! I promise that I will write one more at least, and have a heroine in it whom your mother will both admire and love," answered Randall, surprised to find how grateful he was for the girl's approval, and how rapidly his trained fancy began to paint the background on which he hoped to copy this fresh human daisy. Abashed by her involuntary outburst, Ruth tried to efface herself behind Saul's broad shoulder, and he brought the conversation back to its starting point by saying in a tone of the most sincere interest, "Speaking of the serial, I'm very anxious to know how your hero comes out. He's a fine fellow, and I can't decide whether he's going to spoil his life marrying that silly woman, or do something grand and generous and not be made a fool of. Upon my soul, I don't know myself. It's very hard to find new finales. Can't you suggest something, Major? Then I shall not be obliged to leave my story without an end, as people complain I'm rather fond of doing." "Well, no, I don't think I've anything to offer. Seems to me it isn't the sensational exploits that show the hero best, but some great sacrifice quietly made by a common sort of man who is noble without knowing it. I saw a good many such during the war, and often wish I could write them down, for it's surprising how much courage, goodness, and real piety is stowed away in common folks ready to show when the right time comes. Tell us one of them, and I'll bless you for a hint. No one knows the anguish of an author's spirit when he can't ring down the curtain on an effective tableau," said Randall, with a glance at his friends to ask their aid in eliciting an anecdote or reminiscence. "Tell about the splendid fellow who had the bridge, like Horatius, till help came." "That was a thrilling story, I assure you," answered Sophie, with an inviting smile. But Saul would not be his own hero, and said briefly, "Any man can be brave when the battle fever's on him, and it only takes a little physical courage to dash ahead." He paused a moment with his eyes on the snowy landscape without, where twilight was deepening. Then, as if constrained by the memory that winter scene evoked, he slowly continued, "One of the bravest things I ever knew was done by a poor fellow who's been a hero to me ever since, though I only met him that night. It was after one of the big battles of that last winter, and I was knocked over with a broken leg and two or three bullets here and there. Night was coming on, snow falling, and a sharp wind blew over the field where a lot of us lay, dead and alive, waiting for the ambulance to come and pick us up. There was skirmishing going on not far off, and our prospects were rather poor between frost and fire. I was calculating how I'd manage, when I found two poor chaps close by who were worse off, so I braced up and did what I could for them. One had an arm blown away and kept up a dreadful groaning. The other was shot bad and bleeding to death for want of help, but never complained. He was nearest, and I liked his pluck, for he spoke cheerful and made me ashamed to growl. Such times make dreadful brutes of men if they haven't something to hold on to, and all three of us were most wild with pain and cold and hunger, for we'd fought all day fasting, when we heard a rumble in the road below and saw lanterns bobbing round. That meant life to us, and we all tried to holler. Two of us were pretty faint, but I managed a good yell, and they heard it. 'Room for one more. Hard luck, old boys, but we're full and must save the worst wounded first. Take a drink and hold on till we come back,' says one of them with a stretcher. 'Here's the one to go,' I says, pointing out my man, for I saw by the light that he was hard hit. 'Nope, that one. He's got more chances than I, or this one. He's young and got a mother. I'll wait,' said the good feller, touching my arm, for he'd heard me muttering to myself about this dear old lady. We always want mother when we're down, you know.' Saul's eyes turned to the beloved face with a glance of tenderest affection, and Aunt Plummy answered with a dismal groan at the recollection of his need that night and her absence. 'Well, to be short, the groaning chap was taken, and my man left. I was mad, but there was no time for talk, and the selfish one went off and left that poor feller to run his one chance. I had my rifle, and guessed I could hobble up to use it if I need be, so we settled back to wait without much hope of help, everything being in a muddle. And wait we did till morning, for that ambulance did not come back till next day, when most of us were past needing it. I'll never forget that night. I dream it all over again as plain as if it was real. Snow, cold, darkness, hunger, thirst, pain, and all around us, cries and cursing, growing less and less, till at last only the wind went moaning over that meadow. It was awful, so lonesome, helpless, and seemingly godforsaken. Hour after hour we lay there side by side under one coat, waiting to be saved or die, for the wind grew strong and we grew weak. Saul drew a long breath and held his hands to the fire as if he felt again the sharp suffering of that night. "And the men?" asked Emily softly, as if reluctant to break the silence. "He was a man. In times like that, men talk like brothers and show what they are. Lying there, slowly freezing, Joe Cummings told me about his wife and babies, his old folks waiting for him, all depending on him, yet all ready to give him up when he was needed. A plain man, but honest and true, and loving as a woman. I soon saw that as he went on talking, half to me and half to himself, for sometimes he wandered a little toward the end. I've read books, heard sermons, and seen good folks, but nothing ever came so close or did me so much as good as seeing this man die. He had one chance and gave it cheerfully. He longed for those he loved and let him go with a goodbye they couldn't hear. He suffered all the pains we most shrink from without a murmur and kept my heart warm while his own was growing cold. It's no use trying to tell that part of it, but I heard prayers that night that meant something, and I saw how faith could hold a soul up when everything was gone but God." Saul stopped there with a sudden huskiness in his deep voice, and when he went on it was in the tone of one who speaks of a dear friend. "Joe grows still by and by, and I thought he was asleep, for I felt his breath when I tucked him up, and his hand held on to mine. The cold sort of numbed me, and I dropped off, too weak and stupid to think or feel. I never should have waked up if it hadn't been for Joe. When I came to, it was morning, and I thought I was dead, for all I could see that was that great field of white mounds like graves and a splendid sky above. Then I looked for Joe, remembering, but he had put my coat back over me and lay stiff and still under the snow that covered him like a shroud, all except his face. A bit of my cape had blown over it, and when I took it off and the sun shone on his dead face, I declare to you, it was so full of heavenly peace I felt as if that common man had been glorified by God's light and rewarded by God's well done. That's all." No one spoke for a moment, while the women wiped their eyes and Saul dropped his as if to hide something softer than tears. "It was very noble, very touching. And you? How did you get off at last?" asked Randall, with real admiration and respect in his usually languid face. "Crawled off," answered Saul, relapsing into his former brevity of speech. "Why not before, and save yourself all that misery?" "Couldn't leave Joe." "Ah, I see. There were two heroes that night." "Dozens, I've no doubt. Those were times that made heroes of men, and women, too." "Tell us more," begged Emily, looking up with an expression none of her admirers ever brought to her face by their softest compliments or wiliest gossip. "I've done my part. It's Magister Randall's turn now." And Saul drew himself out of the ruddy circle of firelight, as if ashamed of the prominent part he was playing. Sophie and her friend had often heard Randall talk, for he was an accomplished raconteur. But that night he exerted himself, and was unusually brilliant and entertaining, as if upon his mettle. The Bassetts were charmed. They sat late and were very merry, for Aunt Plummy got a little supper for them, and her cider was as exhilarating as champagne. When they parted for the night and Sophie kissed her aunt, Emily did the same, saying heartily, "It seems as if I'd known you all my life, and this is certainly the most enchanting old place that ever was." "Glad you like it, dear. But it ain't all fun, as you'll find out tomorrow when you go to work. For Sophie says you must," answered Mrs. Bassett, as her guest trooped away, rashly promising to like everything. This is the end of part 1. Next week we will continue with the finale of this story. Thank you.